The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 5, 2016. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all today. Stephen Batchelor, in his book, I think it's, what is it, Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist or something like that. It's been a while now since I read it. But he tells in the back of that book a kind of a tale of the life of the Buddha that differs somewhat from the traditional stories that we get of the Buddha. I think it's very good. I mean, it shows, he's quite a scholar. He's dug into this a bit. And the story that he tells there really hangs together very well. And it just makes a lot of sense, stripped of any kind of mythology and that sort of thing. And there he tells of the Buddha. I mean, traditionally he's presented as a prince. His father was a king. He would inherit a kingdom, this sort of thing. Well, it's been pointed out in recent years that that's maybe a bit of an exaggeration or not quite the correct story. Batchelor points out that, the Buddha did appear as though he very likely came from a fairly well-to-do family. And as was typical of families of some wealth at that time and in that culture, to send their sons, maybe the eldest son, send them off to Persia, I believe it was, to get an education. So he went, along with other young men, no doubt, from well-to-do families, and maybe spent some time there, being exposed to all kinds of other ideas, Zoroastrianism, for one thing, and other kinds of ideas and experiences, you know, very clear. But then Batchelor tells of this, probably on his travels, you see, he traveling through this area, going from his homeland to Persia. He travels across, like the Indus River, and went through this area that we didn't know about until not even quite 100 years ago. That there was this great civilization there in that part of the world. Batchelor doesn't describe this so much, but he talks about the fact that the Buddha, later in his teachings, he gives a story of, uses this example of, say you're traveling somewhere on some kind of pilgrimage or whatever, and you pass by this area of maybe thick, you know, what, jungle growth, whatever, and you wander off a bit from the road, and you come upon these ruins of this huge city somewhere there in the jungle. Well, there would have been these kinds of ruins at the time of the Buddha, and you would have crossed through this area where there would be these ruins. It's now called the Harappan culture. When we first discovered this in the 1920s, I believe, when we first started uncovering this, it was called the Indus River Civilization. Now, the archaeologists, they refer to it as a Harappan civilization, named after a modern-day community called Harappa. But it seems to me, I think we could call, I refer to them as Maluan. The reason for that is, in studying some of this, I noticed that the Sumerians at that time were trading, and we have it in their writings, and we also know how to pronounce the different terms that they use. They referred to these people, that civilization, to their east, in what we now would now think of as North India and Pakistan. They would refer to them as Maluan. But anyway, there was this great civilization. Now, these are people who had paved roads. This is how we first discovered, by finding the pavement stones. Cities with paved roads. They had plumbing. They were apparently very clean. They had a lot of public baths, that sort of thing. And in their arts and in their, and they have writing, which we can't read. We need a new Rosetta Stone for this language. But we can't read their writings, but there's plenty of writings available now that they've uncovered. And there's like 50 large cities. I mean, cities of like 50,000 people. Well, not all of them, but tens of thousands of people, many of them. These are huge cities for that time. We're talking about something that was in ruins maybe 1,000 years before the time of the Buddha. So there's a great civilization. Another thing is interesting, in their art, they don't show, there's very, very few depictions, and also in their artifacts that are lying around, very few weapons. They seem to be a very peaceful people of a very high culture. And I wouldn't be at all surprised, I'm not sure if I read this now or not, but I know that the concept of zero was there in that part of the world. And from there it went into China, eventually into Arabia, where we pick it up. Not just zero, but decimal numerals, which is, you know, very advanced. Far more advanced than anything they had in Europe even centuries later. So very high civilization that completely collapsed. And why did it collapse? Well, there's probably very good evidence. Not probably, there's very good evidence. A lot of these cities that are now in ruin that they've now uncovered, all over the place there. They were built along rivers that no longer exist. These rivers that no longer, well, the Indus River is still there. But there are many other rivers, including one quite large river. That's no longer a river. But we can see the remains of it, you know, the traces, you know, the riverbed and all of this. And the cities that, you know, sprung up around it. Well, these rivers all dried up because, well, ever since the melting of the, you know, of the glaciers after the Ice Age 15,000 years ago or so, there was all this melt coming from all the glaciers up in the Himalaya, you know, the mountains there that have been melting as the earth was warming. And then about maybe 7,000 years ago or so, this warming period that had gone on for 8,000 years maybe since the Ice Age ended and the climate began to warm up, this stabilized and stopped. This period of warming stopped. And the period of where the oceans were rising, it stopped. The sea levels had been rising. They rose over 400 feet from the time of the first melting until eventually it stabilized about 7,000 years ago. And a lot of this runoff was coming from the Himalaya. Hima, by the way, means snow. Alaya, I love this. Alaya means storehouse, you know. So Himalaya means where the snow is stored. That's where the Himalaya mountains are. We say Himalaya, but it's Himalaya. Anyway, all this melting of the glaciers was flooding down these rivers. But eventually all of this stopped. We went into this kind of a very stable, you know, hiatus, global climate. It just more or less became very stable, very unusual to be as stable as it has been all over these past 7,000 years. Of course, it's beginning to change now, and the sea levels are beginning to rise once again. But during this time, there was a lot of these rivers. Well, when the global climate stabilized, these rivers, most of them, there wasn't that much runoff anymore coming from the Himalaya. So most of these rivers dried up. As I said, the Indus is still flowing, but it's just one of where there were many fairly great rivers, many of them. Anyway, that all stopped, and perhaps that had something to do with the collapse of this civilization. So here we come to a point where Stephen Batchelor tells the story of the Buddha on his travels to Persia for his education, experiencing all kinds of things, and no doubt probably passed by a place where later in a story that he's telling, he uses this image of walking on a road, and you leave the road, you go in through the jungle a bit, and you come upon these ruins, which still would have been probably quite visible in the way that we find, say, ruins in Southeast Asia, you know, stuff like that, Angkor Wat, and places like this, or in Central America, where it hasn't been that long. But now today, in our modern day, we weren't even aware of this civilization until we started uncovering some of these artifacts. Not even 100 years ago now. And now we realize how extensive all of this was. Well, anyway, at the Buddhist time, you're probably still seeing structures, you know, there in the jungle, whatever. And using this to tell a very incredible story of Stephen Batchelor, I won't get into that now. But what's important about this, when the Buddha traveled then back to India, Batchelor then tells this story, or he gives this kind of a proposition that maybe this is, you know, what was going on, that the Buddha, from a fairly well-to-do family, eldest son, whatever, what they wanted from him is family obligation was that he would provide them with an heir. He would produce an heir to inherit what would be his. And so the Buddha then came back, as Batchelor put, and no doubt he had an arranged marriage. Some stories were that he was married fairly young. Maybe he was married even before he went off to get his education or whatever. But this is all done through family and arrangement. It's part of the culture and that sort of thing. It's completely different than how we might form couples today and families and this sort of thing. It's just the whole culture, everything is different about that. It might be helpful for us to at least be aware of that. Not to pin down exactly, well, how was it exactly? And are these images that Stephen Batchelor provided us with, are these accurate? Is this really telling us how it was? I don't know that we can say so. But I think it should be obvious to us that however it was at the time of the Buddha, and what they experienced and what they knew of the world and all of this would be radically different from what we know and what we experience and how we think and carry on today. So anyway, the Buddha came back and living up to his family's expectations. He had a son, who he named Ruhula, which means burden, by the way. But then he left, and this is the story that we have, that he left behind as the story would be, that we get today, many of us have heard, that his opportunity to become, you know, a king, a monarch, something like this. It probably really isn't the case, but the way Batchelor presents it is that, he had a family obligation, he lived up to that, he did that, he provided them with an heir, and then he left because of all that he had learned, he was now very disturbed by what he was, you know, seeing and facing in the world. We have the story. The traditional story is that he left the palace of his father, the king, and this sort of thing, and then saw a sick man, an old man, a corpse. So this was very disturbing for the Buddha, the young man. He wasn't the Buddha yet. But when he saw this, and he saw something, this kind of suffering, it's like, well, he didn't know about this before. He didn't see this before. He was sheltered from all this, as the stories go. But then he also met a sattu, you know, a holy man, whatever, who could sit in the midst of all of this trouble and suffering and be completely calm and tranquil about it all. And so with that inspiration, the Buddha set out on his quest to gain enlightenment, to finally understand, to fully realize this human situation. Well, that's kind of the traditional story that we have. Remember, we showed a film here of Dr. Mark Moosey, through the teaching company. We got permission to show this. We showed the section that he had in one of his courses on the Buddha. It was actually a larger course, but there was a little section on the Buddha. And it was very interesting the way Moosey presents this. He says, do you really believe that this young man, Siddhartha, he's very intelligent and accomplished in many ways. Do you really think that he could live to be 29 years old or so, as it was when he finally left his parents' compound, his father's compound there, that he had never seen pain or suffering, sickness or death? Well, it would seem that maybe what this story is telling us about the Buddha's awakening like this and witnessing these things is that, sure, you know, we see this growing up, we know about death, sickness, that sort of thing, yeah. And we're maybe to some degree inured to it, perhaps, maybe, maybe not so much. But it's like we don't really see this, we don't really know this. We can say that we all know that we're going to die, but do we really know this? How vivid is this for us? Well, Musi puts it that maybe what these stories are telling us is that at that time, the Buddha finally saw the human situation for what it is and was greatly disturbed by that. Had to do something about this. Well, in my mind, this all hangs together very well. What I'm trying to set up here is to give us some sense of the fact that the stories that we get, they might give us a flavor or a taste of what has gone on in the past, where these kinds of ideas and stories and images come from actual true life experiences that people have had. But we easily take these things and pin them down. You know, this is the story. This is how it was. And then we really believe that. These stories might be woven into all kinds of mythology and ideas and explanations that people had to explain things that they couldn't explain. And so we end up with all kinds of images of all sort coming to us from these ancient stories. And it's interesting to know that with some modern scholarship where we can reach back and we can kind of see traces of where some of these ideas might be coming from and how they could be interpreted in this way or that way by people who, you know, compared to, you know, our experience with the world, with all our travel and this sort of thing and mass communication, rapid communication, all this sort of thing that we have today. We might be able to see that for people living in those times where they had a limited sense of the world or the history, they knew nothing about ice ages or any of this. So what I'm saying is that we could take these stories and hold them loosely and then just look at them, because these stories do tell us something very deep about human life, human existence, and the situation here that we all experience. But I think it's a big mistake if we take any of these bits and pieces and hang on to them in some, you know, literally. And even the accounts I gave you now, which from a more perhaps modern perspective, using knowledge that we've uncovered in recent times and this sort of thing, and Stephen Baxter and Musi's musings and something, you know, some of these things. Even so, I think this can be helpful for us to, you know, to take this in, to take this into account. But I wouldn't grasp any of it. I wouldn't hold to any of it, thinking, ah, this is it. This is the truth. This is reality. It's like this, and this is what happened, and that's what these stories mean. Now, this practice and this way that we have is very general. It's not about picking things up, holding to one version as opposed to another, and then believing this or believing that. Getting into arguments now with people or holding to some other particular view. Now, that's very helpful for you. You can be aware of these other views that people have. I wouldn't hold them. I would recommend, you know, don't hold them, but don't hang on to whatever views, counter views that you might have always been attached to or felt or whatever. Hold it all rather loosely and then just look at this situation. Because the truth you're going to find in this situation comes out of this moment, right here. But that contains all of these experiences. The rigid beliefs that people hold, the kinds of stories and events that may have been there, the details of which are lost to us. We don't really know we don't know that the Buddha, you know, saw this. We don't know that it was actually remnants of this Maluan culture, or if they really did call themselves Maluan. I just use this term, but I don't hang on to it with the idea that, yeah, those were the Maluan people. But we can be aware of these things. Are you tracking what I'm saying? Because the moment we grasp something, pin it down, then we get into trouble. And then in particular, of course, we like to do this. We like to have a handle on stuff. And then also, we'll take these stories coming from completely different cultures and times. Whether or not we're gleaning some information from these events and things that we maybe have uncovered now in recent times and interpreted through maybe with a larger background of knowledge, but also times that are also far more remote for us than it would be for people that lived around those times. But, you know, if we take any of this and really pin it down, we can get into trouble. The reason I'm talking about all of this, why I brought it up today, was it was about 6 weeks ago. I received a letter. Occasionally I receive letters from various folks, and by the way, if there's anybody listening to this, no, I'm not inviting people to write to me or anything. I get too much mail as it is, and I can't respond to it all, particularly if it's written letters. An email, maybe, if it's short enough, I can maybe get back. But maybe. Anyway, I had another letter from a woman out in Pennsylvania, last winter or something, and then I did respond to her with a written letter. And unfortunately, I couldn't quite read her return address. And so the result was that the letter I sent back to her in response came back to me. So any of you listening out there, if you are going to send me something, actually a self-addressed stamped envelope would be the best way to do it. But anyway, just to set all this aside. But anyway, I received this letter from this woman, and she was actually in New York. And her concern was that in her readings, that she had read that the Buddha, is it true, that the Buddha left his wife and children, and his wife was pregnant even, he left his wife and children and never contacted them again. Now fortunately, she said, I don't know if this is true, but she wanted to get my comment on it. And I thought it was very good, at least didn't clamp down on that. But that was the, through her readings or whatever, that was what she heard or understood. But this is the sort of thing then that can happen. Because maybe we're interpreting it like in our modern setting. So the Buddha, so he was like a deadbeat dad, huh? And he just skipped out. Thinking of the nuclear family, the small family, not realizing that these people were, it was a whole clan of people. And he had a particular obligation to them, to provide them with an heir and this sort of thing. In other words, we would have to put all of this in a totally different context that we're not at all familiar with. And no doubt there's all sorts of other things, and who knows how accurate those impressions are, but probably something on that order. And many other things as well, details and things that we're not privy to. No, we don't know. We have no idea. But we will take things like this, and then, try to extract something and interpret it with the, values and the understandings of what constitutes a family and this sort of thing, from our modern perspective. Not just our modern time, but our own peculiar culture that we live in now. So this is a problem. And this woman then was also concerned that maybe, or she understood as well, that the Buddha never talked to women, or that women never came to her. It was always men who would come to listen to him and that sort of thing. And she was wondering if this was, the case today. And, of course, we don't really know that that was the case then. And I also wanted to mention, too, that, and she said that then the Buddha left and he never even contacted them again. Well, again, I wouldn't hold that too tightly, and I wouldn't hold what I'm about to say now too tightly, but there's all kinds of evidence that, or stories, or descriptions. Of all the Buddha, he was raised by his stepmother. His mother died shortly after he was born. He was raised by his stepmother, but both his son Rahula and his stepmother, they later came and joined his order. So it wasn't that he never contacted them again. And there are also cases and stories where he would go back to his homeland area and do some teaching there. So he wasn't just this deadbeat guy who just took off and left them in the lurch. He left them in a situation where, with a well-off family and a large clan, all of this, where they would be, no doubt, probably well taken care of, that sort of thing. But he had to do this other thing. And later, as a teacher, some of them came and joined him. It seems to me that maybe, possibly, even his wife, the Buddha's wife, was in this group of women who came with the Buddha's stepmother to ask, you know, to receive his teaching and this sort of thing. And then they also formed this the order of bhikkhunis, who, you know, women who would become you know, kind of equivalent to the bhikkhus, the monks. And so maybe we use the term nun for that, but the term would be bhikkhuni. Anyway, but precisely what happened there, we don't really know. But then the question is, well, what about today then? About the role of women, and do women have, if at the time, at the information she had is at the time of the Buddha didn't even talk to them or speak to them, which probably isn't really the case at all. The Buddha's message is universal and it's open to all. Of course, it's being filtered through a particular culture, and very often in various places women have had subordinate roles and this sort of thing, and been kept from things in various ways, in various places and times over a century. I mean, for the most part, that's probably how it's been. But that certainly is not what the Buddha's insight would dictate or say. In fact, it doesn't dictate or really say anything at all along these lines, other than that this is something universal. So I can tell you, now, whether or not this is in the hands of even modern-day people who might have rules and ideas and regulations and restrictions in their mind and how they might operate, even, you know, in Buddhist communities and things like that, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there are, you know, such things. But I can tell you, well, I'll just speak for myself, I guess, that I don't see this at all. That there is no distinction that we can draw between people of any kind. You know, male or female, or race or ethnicity, or, you know, sexual preference, or any of these kinds of things. However you want to draw the lines, and however it is that we do draw the lines, when it comes to this matter of taking up this way and making this effort to live out of awakeness, this doesn't matter. Your skin color, you know, the language you speak, any of these kinds of things. These are all completely inconsequential, have no bearing on any of this at all. I hope that we conduct ourselves here in a way, you know, and Norm and I, you know, demonstrate that there aren't any of these kinds of things. At least coming from our teaching or from the way that we practice. It just isn't there. And I would say that if you had any kind of restrictions, you know, built into whatever system it is you might want to get involved with, well, in terms of any kind of a spiritual practice or enlightenment or waking up to truth and reality and living out of that, that would be a flawed system. Because you can't have those kinds of restrictions. They simply don't apply. This is for people with human minds. That's it. Dogs and cats, cows, you know, maybe they don't need the practice. I don't know how you would even go about that anyway. But for human beings with these incredible, wonderful human minds that we all have, of course, some can be, you know, we could say damaged or injured in various ways. You know, maybe so. But that still doesn't put up a barrier that you can't, to your capacities, just take this up. But it has nothing to do with whether you're male or female or any other kind of distinction you want to make. So even though that, you know, in our culture today, you know, where we hang on to these various kinds of identities, we might think that these things are important, that they actually signify something. Well, maybe they do in very limited ways. But it doesn't apply to what it is that we're talking about here, about living out of awakeness. It doesn't apply there at all. And as for where it is that we think we can apply these things, I would say you better be careful with all of that. And don't box anybody up, shut them out, or limit them in some way. You know, there's just something going on in your own mind. And then if you were to act on that and actually try to set up barriers and things out there in the world, you know, just look at what you're doing. This is about waking up to truth, which is already known directly and available to us all. But you can't do that if you hang on to anything at all, any particular interpretation of the Buddha's life or what he did. Look at what he did. Did he do that? Did he leave his kids? You know, never mind that. Be aware of such things, that such things come up in the world. How people are cast off and characterized and limited in various ways. Be aware that all of this is taking place. It does go on. But what it is that we take up here, what we practice here, the mind we want to open up to here is completely open and tolerant and magnanimous and flexible. It's ready for every moment. Not to cast any of it off, not to shut any of it out. Not to characterize any of it as good or bad. It is just this coming up. We take care of it. Certain kinds of things go on in the world and within our own mind and within our own actions that cause pain and suffering. So we have this formless admittance that we recite from time to time. That we admit, yeah, through our own error, through our own folly, our own foolishness and ignorance. Yeah, on occasion we get caught in these ways. But we bring ourselves back to this again and again, that we want to release this, be open from this, and to not try to pin anything down here. To use that wonderful word that Norm has coined, you know, this is unpin-downable. You can't take hold of any of this, the reality that you are living out. You don't need to. You only need to see it, to realize it, to know it, and to act out of that knowing. Not out of ideas, not out of beliefs, not out of characterizations of them or this and that or one thing or another. But as things are coming up in this moment, to be ready with that, present with that, see that. To be aware of your own prejudices and your own leanings of mind and this sort of thing, the things that you might grip when you see them being irritated because it's clashing with something. Know that. And our normal way then is to strike out at them, whoever they are. They're offending me in some way. We never go that way. Just stop right here. Don't attack yourself either. Just see what's going on. And you can come to know and to realize that anything that you are gripping, anything you're hanging on to, anything you're pinning down, it's just some delusion going on in your mind. It is not reality. When we can see this and know this directly for itself, you can open the hand. Open the hand of thought. You just let this go. This isn't to become willy-nilly and, oh, okay, anything goes. No, this is, as I said, we're in this world, things come up to us, whatever it is. We remain aware of this, but we don't need to be caught by this. We can become aware of what is linked to suffering and confusion and pain and hatred and all of that. And it's only through that awareness that we can realize what that is and immediately, we can realize immediately what that is. And if we truly see what that is, if we really see it, in the way that Musi was talking about the Buddha, when the Buddha really saw what suffering was, then we can find liberation. We can wake up to how to be free from this. So anyway, I guess that's all I want to say. I guess partly I wanted to say this here so I don't have to write a long letter. But any questions about anything I said this morning? Yes, Andrew.
Yeah, I just wanted to share an anecdote of my own that kind of piggybacks on the story of the Buddha that you told me as well. Last fall, I've been working with the monk community for over 30 years, and I know when you introduce yourself by your last name first. Like if you met somebody, you would say, I'm Hagen Steve. It took me a little while to learn this, but what they value first is the importance of the clan over the individual.
Yeah.
Anyway, last fall I was at a conference and I was talking to my mom and I said, oh, where's your husband? I've not seen him in a while. And she said, well, he's off in Thailand. And I said, oh, is he visiting? Is your family back there? And she said, no, he left us to join a monastery, a Buddhist monastery. I think back in the day, if I had heard that, my reaction would have been shock. But now that I'm a part of Dharma Field, I just sort of gently smiled. And I said, well, is there somebody looking after you and the boys? And she said, well, we're with his brother now. You know, that's how our community works. And then I said, when do you expect to see him again? And she just simply said, we will see him when he's ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So it's a tradition that is outside of Western views that continues today.
And so what we need to do is, when we encounter this, people with that have a different way or a different view of the world or whatever, or we're reading stuff through history, you know, in ancient literature, whatever. But we have to realize, just watch your own mind and realize, you know, what you're doing when we might start to cast judgment. We're not in a position really to judge. And that shouldn't be our first concern. Our concern should always be with just wake up. What are you doing now? But yeah, thank you for that, Andrew. Yeah. It does help to experience other cultures firsthand. I remember when I was in Japan, and it was a way where people just think radically differently from the way that I was familiar with here in our culture. And, you know, after you kind of get over the fascination and all that kind of stuff, and then you kind of start settling in to the culture a bit. And after, I don't know, a few months or something, a couple months, where I was just, I remember I was riding on the train, and where I was just about ready to explode, just because this culture was so strange and so weird, and the way that people thought and how they reacted to things. And suddenly I realized, I saw the woman coming along giving the bento, I forget now, but the little lunches and things that she was passing out on the train coming toward me and that sort of thing. And I'm looking around. The train's running on time. It's a vast and complex and beautiful culture, cities and dwellings and the rice paddies, all of this. I realized, but here's a culture. It operates completely differently. The assumptions that people make are completely different than our own. And yet here it is, and it's working smoothly and beautifully. The problem was mine. It was not this crazy culture, how foolish and stupid these people are. What's wrong with them? Why can't they do it like this? The problem was with me. And I remember I relaxed at that point and settled down and maybe enjoyed the rest of the ride. I don't know. But it's helpful. You know, you come up against... And I remember it was about a year after that, while I was in Japan, I wrote the Thich Nhat Hanh in France, and Plum Village was pretty new at that time. And anyway, and then he invited me to come to France. So I did the next year, and there, I remember, there weren't that many people there at that time. It was just, 30, 40 people maybe. Now I guess it's huge, but anyway, there was a small contingent there, different Americans that came. We all came independently, I think, or maybe a couple people came in pairs or whatever. But there were 10 or 12 of us at the most. I don't know if even that many, but I remember the Americans, and several of them, were having a great deal of trouble adjusting to this particular culture. Well, it was an odd mixture of things. So here we were in France, and then some of the things were Vietnamese, that were immediately around us and that sort of thing. But just finding it so difficult. And I understood that feeling, because I had kind of gone through the bends or whatever back when I was, when I was in Japan. But here they were basically in France, which isn't that foreign from, say, where Japan is from where we are. Because much of what we were experiencing was simply French, somewhat Vietnamese mixed in. But anyway, this is something that would be very helpful for us. Oh, I think like foreign exchange students, this sort of thing, we get to know each other, get to know our cultures, get to know people, families, and things from different places. Maybe then we don't get caught up with ideas of insane ideas of like banning, that race or that culture, that religion from our shores and stuff like that. It's how dangerous that is, that kind of thinking. And the resentments and the warring and the hatred and everything that will rise out of that. So just be open to it all, and all people. Maybe what they do, it's strange, I don't get that. Get to know them as a human being. We can broaden ourselves, we can make ourselves larger and richer. Doesn't mean we necessarily adopt the ways that other people take about this or that, but we can appreciate these things. We don't need to condemn. Of course, there might be certain kinds of activities and things that are hurtful and injurious, but maybe in a sane and compassionate way, we can start to understand this and maybe help people who are caught up in such confusion to help them out of their confusion. But it won't come from us trying to inject our way on them. It can only come from maybe helping them to see what they're doing. This is the case for all of us. Watch your own mind. Wake up to what you're doing. And we don't need to reject any of it or condemn any of it or characterize it any particular way. So as I would say to the woman who wrote me that letter, at least to hear, can't speak for all places, but as I understand these teachings and this practice, the fact that male or female doesn't matter. Has no bearing on this, and it certainly has no bearing or carries any weight one way or the other in my mind. So, okay, anything else? Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.